You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Newport millionaires and a real-life topless cellist and beat poets are just some of the characters who show up in Erica Beale's new novel, Wild Girls. It begins in the 1950s and follows three classmates at a women's college as they make their way in the world. Each woman chooses a different path, but they all struggle with the strict societal norms of the time. Wild Girls is published by the Texas Review Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Erica Beale to our show. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
Your first novel, Women Like Us, is also about a group of students at a women's college. Why did you decide to go back to this subject that you'd covered before?
I guess I feel like I almost own the period, and the period owns me, and I'm haunted by it. I want to keep exploring different stories. The stories in Wild Girls are quite different from the ones in Women Like Us. And it's, in a way, it's an angrier book and talks more about the sexual damage that was inflicted on women of that period.
And a little more explicit than the previous book. Didn't you go to Sarah Lawrence when it was still exclusively a women's college?
I did, I confess, because it becomes Foxley in the novel.
Mm-hmm. Well, right now you'd only have Bryn Mawr and a few others that have held out.
Smith,
I guess, yeah. What was that experience like? Do you think it would have been different if you'd gone to a co-ed school?
Well, I think that what was so different about Sarah Lawrence, or Foxley, I like to think of it as, is that it really kind of fostered a kind of rampant individualism, and it, in a way, it created the soil from which my characters could flourish and rebel, in effect, against the entire society of that period.
But you've talked about the women who came of age in the 1950s as being part of a lost generation.
Absolutely. I think that, well, Betty Friedan later on would talk about the problem that has no name. And these were women, basically, who felt they had to conform to the only model available to women then, which was marriage and family. And what is lost is their contribution to the larger world, their voices.
So you're suggesting that there were women of that generation who would be well-known today as artists and thinkers if they hadn't succumbed to the cultural norms of the time?
Conceivably, and some of them, in effect, changed course midlife and did fulfill their potential in different fields.
Often later.
But what is striking about my trio is that they start out from the very beginning in the 50s feeling that way. They want no part of the culture that is demanding that they conform to a certain model.
So they do some unusual things for the time, go to Paris to be part of the Beat Generation, live with a married man, and so on. I guess we should mention their names, Brett, Audrey, and Julia. Are they inspired by any people you knew?
Well, to some extent, I draw Brett from myself, partly because it helps to not have to do research all the time. And I didn't have to do as much research on Brett as I did on the others. But yes, they are very much composites. And in a way, I hope that they're real individuals. But they also reflect characters from that period, women I knew, and their passions, people who have since disappeared, I'm sad to say.
But looking at your career, it doesn't look like you suppressed any of your creative urges. You were a dancer for a time.
And yes.
Then you were a professor of French at CUNY before you decided to start writing books and journalistic pieces.
Well, but I think there are risks involved in really living against your own time. To be an expat in Paris in that period was extremely risky. I was probably the only woman there, and I hung out with the Beats at the infamous Beat Hotel.
And well, then, Gertrude Stein had covered that territory earlier.
Well, that was way earlier, and this was kind of what I call in the book sort of the tag end, you know, of the expat movement, the dregs of it.
Well, a lot of the expats in the 50s in Paris were former GIs who had decided to stay, or people who were painters who were attracted to the famous French artists before New York became the center of the art world.
True. I guess my characters do not encounter those people. They really hang out with the Beats. Brett in particular hangs out with the Beats and a whole circle of artistic individuals and hangers-on who surrounded them.
And the Beats had left New York and California to spend time in Paris?
They had. Not Kerouac, but Ginsberg, Gregory Corso, and William Burroughs were all at the Beat Hotel. And I have a line that amuses me when I think of it. There's a character in there who, Gregory Corso wants to induce Kerouac to come and join them in Paris. And he holds forth the incentive of his girlfriend. He said, you know, you can have her if you come to Paris. And this was their attitude towards women. They treated them like sexual wampum.
I actually accidentally bumped into Ginsberg and Corso in Paris the first time I was there. And what I remember, knowing who they were, Alan said, he was not next to me or anything like that, but I overheard him saying in English, "Okay, Gregory, I'll meet you at Pont Neuf later today at 5 o'clock.
That actually surprises me because of all of them, Alan made some effort to learn French.
Well, maybe it was Gregory. Maybe it was one of the
others. It must have been Gregory saying that.
Alan, I'll meet you. But anyway, none of these women, Brett, Audrey, and Julia, seem to really find happiness by not following the norm.
Well, that's questionable because Audrey, I don't want to give away the plot, but up to a certain point in her life, she finds great happiness. And so does Julia. The denouement of those situations may not be rosy, but they certainly have their moment of great happiness in life.
You include many real-life characters in the book. Why not fictionalized versions of Allen Ginsberg, Bonnie Rossett, or Charlotte Moorman, among others?
I think Charlotte is named by name, but that's a very good question, and it is inconsistent, and
she was the only bare-breasted cellist we all...
Well, yes, she's
anybody from that time remembers her.
Identifiable. Oh. But I don't think that a novelist needs to be consistent. There are no rules in fiction writing, and my sense was at the time that it felt better to me to write it this way than to give him a fake name. Whereas the Yoko character, whom I call Rinko, I felt uncomfortable with using her name. And I cannot justify it logically. It just worked better as writing.
And that's based on something in your own life? Hadn't you shared an apartment with Yoko Ono at some point?
Yes. Yoko was at Sarah Lawrence in the 50s, and then she left to join the New York downtown avant-garde scene. And then we we were roommates in the early 60s.
What was she like as a roommate?
Well,
she's been a great guest on this show.
She's a wonderful character to write about. I guess she was a mixed blessing. She was always fascinating, and my character, Brett, is very excited to be a part, you know, of this totally cool avant-garde scene. On the other hand, there's a price to pay because she was enormously ambitious, and anything that she perceived as standing in the way of that created problems.
Brett experiences sexism in the publishing industry. Don't women make up the majority of people working in the publishing industry?
Well, this was, remember, in the early 60s at a Grove Press-like publisher. And the women there were
Barney Rossett's publishing company.
Exactly. And the women there were kind of like fleas on the back of a yak or something. They were almost, they had busy work, nothing jobs, including Brett's immediate boss, who's the publicity director, who spends all of her time looking for an apartment for her boyfriend so he'll marry her.
Many of the real-life men in this book, even those whom we think of as artistic geniuses, turned out to be quite sexist. How much of the dismissive attitude towards women is still around today, do you think?
Well, of course, all that's changing. My goodness. There's been such a huge arc coming from the 50s to now. In the 50s, it was acceptable and, you know, part of the lexicon. Now, 1,000 people will leap down the throat of someone who witnessed Trump who behaves that way.
There's a T-shirt, "I'm a nasty woman." T-shirts.
Well, I think of my characters as the original badass, nasty women.
You follow them from the mid-1950s to the late 1990s. Were certain periods more interesting to you than others because you skipped some decades altogether?
Well, I love time jumps. What I like to write about is the entire arc of someone's life, a whole great big swath of time. And so the time jumps are really, I mean, you know, you can't write it day by day. It's really to show how things have turned out, which is always a thing about fiction that fascinates me. I want to know how things turn out in lives. And so that's why I make those jumps. But I have to say I have a particular fondness for the 50s and the early 60s, which is a period that has been not really explored sufficiently and has so many fascinating things about it as kind of the underside of the culture that is beginning to change everything.
The late 50s and early 60s felt like the pre-Renaissance. And then, unfortunately, the Renaissance came and went very quickly.
Yes. But these people who anticipated everything were kind of amazing. I mean, they were up against this massive corporate culture and lack of approval from the society. They were really pushing back against all the power of that period.
How much of this is based on your memory? How much of it was based on research? And did you keep journals at the time?
I did have journals, and I think that that's a very hard question to answer because it's all kind of seamless. A lot of it I remember. A lot of it is research. A lot of it, some of it is even interviews.
Mm-hmm. And you've also done quite a bit of journalism, so you probably drew upon those skills in writing this book, because this
absolutely
book deals a lot with the real world.
Yes.
Even though it's a work of fiction.
Yes, I really, one thing I really wanted to do, I'm tired of reading books that are completely navel-gazing. I wanted to show the larger world and this culture that they're embedded in. And that was a very important part of the intent of this book. I love to write satirically, and there are so many things there that lend themselves to humor, like Brett's situation at the Grove Press place where Barney Rossett is continually asking, who is this person? Does she work here?
Did you speak French fluently when you went to Paris?
No, I didn't at all.
So you drew upon that time there in becoming a professor of French.
Yes, I basically learned French there. But I can say this now because I'm post-tenure and I've left the academy, but I never really learned it in the formal way that one should, perhaps. I learned it from reading Céline the way Brett does in her experience in Paris.
Now, Céline is one of perhaps the second greatest French writer of the 20th century after Proust, but not respected these days because he was also a fascist.
He was a collaborator.
But he also wrote in slang. And so were you teaching your students at CUNY the kind of slightly obscene French that Céline often utilized?
No way. We were reading Alphonse Daudet or something. But no, Céline is an important figure in the novel because the beats worshipped him. And his style of the three dots and the kind of very fast, excited, crazy talking was the type of style that the Beats emulated.
He uses a lot of ellipses, and he once wrote that the typographers of France were angry with him because they were running out of periods.
I have a scene that I love where they all go to visit him in Meudon, and Brad is there theoretically as a translator, but her French is very shaky. And he's making anti-Semitic remarks that she tries to cloud over, but Allen Ginsberg catches them.
Now, you have written fiction and nonfiction. Are you at work on another book?
Yes, I'm working on another book about the 70s, the early 70s, the height of feminism, and it's going to be a satirical and comic novel.
Meanwhile, we have this book, Wild Girls. It is published by I'm now suddenly losing it.
Texas Review Press.
And my great thanks to Erica Abeel for being on our show.
Nice to be here.